Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is with Daniel Zuckerbrod and Julie Eng. We talk about the science of magic. I know it sounds kind of crazy, and for some maybe even a little ludicrous, and maybe even a bit corny, but it's really quite a fascinating doc. It's on CBC. You can check it out there by looking online or following the link in the bio on Rabble or the Face to Face page. We talk about problems of perception. We talk about subverting reality and about these ideas of free will, and you're going to see how magic is used as a paradigm, as a way of approaching something like that Daniel talks a great deal about, called change blindness. Like I said, we talk about free choice and free will in not only in the film, but in how it relates to the average and the everyday. And Julie and Daniel are both magicians. Julie appears in the film, and we talk about things like perceptual influence, and also we kind of wind up on humility and hope. How wonderful is that? So stay tuned for a wonderful and fun interview with one returning guest, Daniel Zuckerbrod, a filmmaker here in Toronto, and a magician out of Toronto with an organization called Magicana, Julie Eng, talking about the science of magic. Coming right up, don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing and speaking, and facetofacelive.ca for more interviews there about pretty much everything. And if you want to support the work I'm doing, you can do that through Patreon as well. Check it out online. Coming right up, Daniel Zuckerbrod, Julie Eng, the science of magic. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a couple of very special guests here today. Friends of mine, actually. Magicians. We've got a filmmaker. We've got a photographer here sitting with us. Julie Eng and Daniel Zuckerbrod here to talk about their new film, The Science of Magic. Daniel is a co-director with his wife, Donna. A real family production, I think. And we're probably going to hear a little bit more about that. But thank you both for joining me today.
Pleasure.
You bet.
So, The Science of Magic.
The science.
Really?
Yeah. Well, it's a bit misleading, isn't it?
A bit misleading.
Right? Because it's, you know, you hear that, you think it's going to be about the science behind the magic trick, how the magic trick works or something.
No revealing. That's too bad.
Some people have complained. And we kind of reveal things.
I think it's more...
You teach a trick or...
Or two. Sort of.
Trick it out. Half.
Well, it makes me wonder, actually. I mean, did you really teach the trick? I mean, isn't this all about that whole, it's about perception, and it's about change blindness, and about
various kinds of blindness.
Various kinds of blindness, frankly, and making assumptions. I mean, that's kind of the stuff I started to peel back. Of course, it's a great film, by the way, and congratulations. And it was so much fun to watch you, Julie, in the film.
Thank you.
And I think my favorite part, though, of the film is David Benn assisting you. captured on camera.
That's for one, for those in the know. Right?
Yes, that's right. That's a little insider's joke, folks. So is there a science of magic? I mean, was that part of the draw? This aired on CBC and still is airing on CBC, right?
Just to be clear. I mean, it's in Canada. It's available on their website, on the Nature of Things website, anytime. Mm-hmm. But there is in the sense that what the film focuses on, is scientists who are inviting magicians like Ms. Eng into their labs in order to draw on The practical knowledge that magicians have about deception, about how to fool the perception, how to fool the attention, in order to design new kinds of experiments, to study consciousness, cognition,
human behavior, yeah, behavior. And attention, and how it, how I guess what magicians use, I guess naturally or intuitively, they're breaking it down and scientifically applying those practices to discern how is it that we really think and observe the world. And it's funny, when I'm watching it all unfold, I'm like, wow, this is almost like a big, you know, charade in many ways. Thinking about one of the experiments in Montreal and setting it up like a show, and right, really establishing the parameters. And it's, you know, like in the old con days of setting up
it's a long con. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the shots of walking through the hallways, yeah, and through the back door and the implications of all that just are fabulous,
well, you
right?
You can imagine. As someone who thinks like a filmmaker, and is a filmmaker yourself, you could imagine what went into that. You know, as soon as we heard about the experiment, I know what this is going to look like.
Yeah, yeah. So is this the kind of film that you build around something like that? The idea is, hey, wouldn't it be great to do an experiment like that? And then you tease it out and you say, you know what? Or is it way more intentional than that?
Yeah, no, it's we start at the other end. I mean, you know, I have a very long interest in filmmaking, and an even longer interest in magic. And Donna, you know, was doing magic shows as a kid in high school. And she probably watches more magic than I do, and
she loves it too.
She loves it. Nice, she's a huge fan, and you know, and we make a lot of science docs. So we've had our eye on these guys who are doing all over the world, scientists who are using magic as an experimental modality. And it's something that began in psychology, certainly in the 1900s. You know, you find papers from the 19th century, in the 1800s, you find papers occasionally. Famous psychologists at the time, like Jastrow and people like that, studying, you know, what happens when a magician makes a ball disappear.
Right.
And you know, so he writes a paper, somebody else writes a paper 10 years later, 30 years later, there's another paper. Suddenly, a few years ago, you started to get paper after paper all over the world, from Japan to England, Canada, scientists using magic to study consciousness. So, you know, we've had our eye on it. And when it was seemed that there was a lot of work going on, mm-hmm, and a lot of it in Canada.
Yes, that was interesting.
Yeah.
And then having that first science of and magicians association, this idea of the two, I know, two opposites, mm-hmm, coming together in a conference.
They seem to be opposites, right?
Yeah. Seemingly opposite, yeah. Yeah. And that was what was interesting, is that a lot of, surprisingly to me, is that a lot of the individuals involved with the experiments were also, you know, longtime magic enthusiasts.
Yeah.
And it was that twinkle that I saw that was interesting inside of them, so explaining their experiments.
That, Julie, is that the scientists you mean?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, many of them were magicians before they were scientists.
Well, that's the question, right? Yeah, were they, sure, magicians first?
Not all of them.
Not all of them.
No, but you can see, and I guess it's really, you know, I've grown up in this world of magic, so when you, it's like a trait, it's a gene, I can see it.
Right, right.
But I can see it. And,
well, and I wonder, to what degree is the problem solver the connection there, right? The problem solver between the wonder of puzzles,
solutions, you know, they're looking for answers,
yeah,
methods, and it's interesting, actually, and they're very charming, I think, in that whole realm, because they want to, I think they wanted to kind of share magic too, but they weren't interested in exposing it, which was nice. You know, right, when remember
less,
even the...
Less than you are professional magicians.
Well, hey, I had to teach the trick, right?
No, I mean, in the sense that they, you know, I think professional magicians, you know, being concerned about exposure tends to be an amateur concern.
Sure.
Right? Professionals, yes, exactly, have a different kind of concern. Partly because they know that if they can tell you a method and then fool you,
with another,
2 minutes later, yeah, you know, I mean, it's not, there aren't those kinds of secrets, or those,
right,
aren't the primary thing.
And
but these guys are,
secret, yeah,
we're very secretive, so much so that Jay Olson in Montreal, who did that experiment that you were,
yes,
mentioning,
yes,
with the MRI machine,
the,
yes,
long con,
yes,
the long con, he, even when they publish it in scientific journals,
he wouldn't reveal
they
the
won't
method,
reveal it. They say, there is a method, We use a magician's trick to do this. If you want more information, you know, if you want to replicate the experiment, contact me.
Wow, fascinating.
He doesn't tell his colleagues. Isn't that interesting?
No, his the operator who was assisting him, who is from the science department, still doesn't know how it works, and he's been helping him with those experiments for the duration of his entire paper and studies.
Yeah, so that's fascinating to me. I mean, just in that alone, the insight sort of into deception and how far you're willing to go in order to...
He was a little intense with his deception. Yeah. He's great. He's a great...
But he represents what extreme they were.
But he was really interested in seeing the entire experiment start to finish in this realm of, okay, if we're going to bring them into this world, we really want to bring them into this world. And he was committed to that, which is admirable, because he wanted to prove that the experiment had, you know, it was interesting. It was the face-to-face stuff that worked very well for him in his experiment. When they put it on the computer, it's just not the same. There is this human dynamic that makes a big part of it. And, of course, in magic.
Of course.
That's what we rely on.
Yeah, yeah. The magic on TV versus magic face-to-face. I mean, there's no comparison, really, right?
Yeah. Interesting. Most people never get to know that, of course.
Right. It's still to this day, after so many years, I'm surprised by how many people, I've never seen a magician before.
Or they see, like, a birthday magician.
Or
Uncle Bob.
Somebody
remember
on the street.
Uncle Bob used to pull pennies out of my ear.
Yeah, everybody does a card trick.
Right.
Jay Olson, I think, said something about insights into free will. Mm-hmm. You know, doing some of these experiments. Do you think that's a bit of a stretch?
Do you think that there's... No, and I think that, I mean, Gustav Kuhn, also in England, who sort of started the Science of Magic Association, he's at Goldsmiths at the University of London, is very, very much sort of drilling down to that issue. I mean, you know, many of these experiments put in doubt the degree of our free will, or it certainly seems that, like in Jay's experiments, that, you know, and he starts off with something simple like having someone pick a card, and we have that wonderful scene of Julie and him out in the streets in Montreal having people select cards,
right?
And everybody's ending up with the same card, and everybody who's being asked, you know, do they have a free choice, says yes, they had a free choice. But we know that the magicians are nudging their choices along in a certain direction. So how did they do it? Well, again,
how can you possibly control a choice, right?
But you have a million ways to do it, right? In fact, you weren't doing it the same way Jay was, right?
No, and I think that was what was interesting, is originally when we did that, Jay had a very specific way of doing it to match his experiment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he was true to his experiment, which was terrific. And I was asked to see if I could replicate it, but using my way of doing it. And it worked out really interestingly, because the best thing for me was the camera guys who were watching Jay do it his way and watching me do it my way. And we must have done, you know, a couple dozen each, right?
Right.
Back to back.
Right.
They're looking at me and they're like, well, I can work out how his is working, but I don't know, how is hers? Like, because I offered the cards, right?
Right.
How is it that the Ten of Hearts keeps coming up?
It
was interesting that the sound guy innocently said that, having not been exposed like Mike was to some of the experiments. Right. And I thought, well that's nice.
Well, you know what's cool too about that for me is about assumption. And we all remember, and maybe the listeners don't, but the masked magician and how some people in the community were so outraged by this guy who was exposing things. But my question always was, why do you assume he's telling you the right answer?
Yeah.
And that's deeply troubling to me. There's something... Forget it was a masked magician. In fact, I left my mask at home. But you know what I mean? But
this actually came up in a way.
Yeah.
You know, because of the Amory Danek, who was at the time in Chicago studying insight, problem solving and insight, you know, where we suddenly
the
get...
The aha moment.
That's right.
Yep.
And one of the things that in her field was a contentious issue that people didn't know about was whether there could be false insights. So if you're studying this problem, suddenly you have an insight into how it works, and you're, you know, that insight's usually, or one of the characteristics is it's accompanied by this emotional thing, you know, maybe you laugh, but you see right to the heart of the problem, you know the answer in one swoop. So many psychologists felt that that meant you had the right answer. So it was difficult to construct experiments to to sort of narrow that down. And she says, you know, one of the great things about using magic as a paradigm is that you, it's the most common thing for people to come up with false insights.
Yes.
So she shows them these magic tricks and asks them to come up with solutions. And often they believe they've come up with the correct solution. And the solutions are some, you know, we didn't include this in the film, but because it was too long a thing, but she was explaining some of the
solutions,
the kinds of solutions. Yeah. So for example, Thomas Fraps, the magician who did the videos for mm-hmm. her of the tricks, put salt and pepper in his hand, mixed them together, and then waves his hand over, and the
salt on one side, the peppers on the other.
One has vanished in this case, right? Okay. So the peppers vanished.
Fun.
And she said people would say things like, "Well, he has one of those little vacuum cleaners up his arm, up his sleeve."
I've got one of those.
And
yeah.
she said, "Well, first off, what's one of those little vacuum
cleaners?" That's right. Yeah.
Secondly, how do you still wouldn't
and
work.
And does Dyson make it? That's what I want to know. Yeah.
But what a great idea. You know, and that in itself is kind of the fun in performing magic, because having people make false assumptions
sure,
all the time
sure,
when
of
you're
course.
Performing.
Yes, the legend grows too, right, on these assumptions as well, which is always fun.
It's in the retelling.
Yeah.
And part of it is you don't want to do another trick, because how many times can you walk on water, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's an analytical mind that is in distress if they can't come up with a solution, a reason, an answer, and they're seeking for this insight. They want this moment of, I need to know, and it frustrates people mm-hmm, sometimes. Mm-hmm. But then when they surrender to the idea that, well, then I just don't know, it's going to be one of those mysteries, it's funny, that's enough to resolve oftentimes, so they don't feel challenged.
Right.
I don't know that.
Certainly mm-hmm. there are types. There is a type of person who enjoys magic, who laughs when they're fooled, who loves that sense of wonder. And
I don't want to know how it's done, people
right.
will
yeah.
say, right?
Right?
Don't even tell me,
that's
kind
right.
of, before
and, you... And there are others who really do feel that challenge, who really...
And I want to talk about that a little bit, because that's what I started to think about, because not everyone just relaxes and goes, isn't it wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
No, it's true.
Some like, that really pisses me off, actually, right? And they'll go and they'll... I have a friend who I'll get a call from, and I'm sure I've spoken about it before in other contexts, and maybe even on my podcast, but he will call me, and he said, okay, I've just watched this thing 3 times in a row, and I still can't figure it out. And you can hear the tone.
The frustration.
Oh, the frustration. And he knows enough about magic to be in sleight of hand, to be dangerous, sort of, and he, no interest in performing,
mm-hmm.
no interest in the history, really. Mm-hmm. It's just, I need to know. And on one hand, I go, okay, I applaud that. That's maybe scientific inquiry, maybe. I don't know. I don't know. But I don't know. Is it ego? Where do you go with that, those folks who don't like magic?
Yeah, I think there's a spectrum, don't you?
For sure. Absolutely. And it's in a range of... My belief is that it's how they were impacted the first time.
Oh,
were you
their
embarrassed?
First experience.
Were you
right.
conned? Were you taken? Like, what was the experience? See, for me, it's experiential. That's why it was very interesting working... with Daniel and Donna and these scientists and watching it unfold in front of me, because it's a whole other experiment. Just as Jay describes, the moment you put this in as, oh, it's an experiment, they're now in context. It changes the dynamic.
Right. We should probably step back and explain that a little bit.
Yeah,
right?
sure.
For
go.
For the listener. Cause, yeah. So Julie came with us to Montreal and participated with Jay in these experiments. That started off simply by having people choose cards and forcing their choices in a certain direction, and because Jay's interested in this question of free choice or free will
or not free will,
or not free will.
Yeah.
I was just trying to think of the term they use. It's not free will, but anyway, that idea.
Determinism.
You know, it's a psychological.
Oh, a psychological
term. Anyway, so what makes us? What happens when we feel we have free choice, like when Julie offers the card, and we don't, but we feel we do.
Right, right.
And Jay was interested in exploring also the opposite, which is what happens when I really do have free choice, but my sense of that is taken from me. And that's very hard to set up experimentally.
It's like you have agency.
Agency,
like that.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so how do you set up a situation where a person feels they've lost agency, that they're no longer
right,
able
right.
to
Well, you've
choose.
Just been sold something then, right? And maybe not even something that you really wanted to buy.
That's
in the
right.
First place,
we have,
right.
We all have that experience.
So maybe
yes.
that's
how do you set that up
yeah,
in a lab?
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you quantify that? How do you run that experiment over and over?
And he created a very interesting experiment where the reverse happens, where people believed they had been given a choice, given an option. You should
explain what it looks like, what happens.
Yeah, I mean, people go in and they are brought in to a science lab. They see this huge MRI machine. It's big and imposing. It's in a dark room. You lay down on it, and they push the subject in. It's all very spooky.
Like an MRI.
It's an imposing.
Brought in through the hospital corridor.
Past
the morgue. Yeah.
The ideological implications, man. You know.
Yeah. And it's like, well.
And it's in the neurological institute. It's inside
the Montreal Neurological Institute.
McGill, was it?
Yeah.
Montreal Neurological Institute.
And the idea was Jay then said to the subjects, we're going to switch on this machine and we're going to have the machine send you some thoughts.
The machine.
And his whole theory of how it works, right? How the MRI, you know, can image the magnetic fields or
electroactivity.
So we're going to reverse it, and we've been able to design it now to manipulate the electromagnetic activity in your brain.
To provide you with an impression of, you know, something we want to send to you. But we can't tell you what that is. So, you know, mm-hmm. we want to make sure we don't spoil your thoughts on this. So we don't want to influence you in any way. And that's a classic magician's ploy. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, for the ones that I was present for, it was great because all of the theatrics that go into planting the idea, which is not possible, mm-hmm. although I just saw on Google.
It's becoming possible, but it's still not possible to plant numbers the way they...
Specific numbers. And people then reported very specific experiences of a buzzing, a feeling, something physiological.
Wanting to choose 41, but it wouldn't come out of their mouth. They were forced to say 92.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really remarkable. And these are all, was revealed to the subjects, this is a free choice. It's whatever number you want.
It's fascinating, too. I think you show, you know, the facial expressions on a couple in particular. Yeah, and I'm sure you had lots, but the stunned look. What do you mean this isn't real?
That's kind
of wasn't real.
Well, or that I was fooled.
That I was fooled. Duped. Yeah, I was duped.
And
yeah, sure.
That for me, in a magic point of view, is not what I'm after.
No, right. No, right, this isn't a magic trick.
Because I think that does precipitate that feeling of people saying, well, I don't like magic. You know, you guys want, because my experience now is that you go out there and your job is to fool me, or you're there to try and get me, or con
to belittle me.
To make me look stupid, basically. You know, it's an interesting problem.
Right.
Well,
and
for Jay, though, it's, you know, well, they won't end up disliking magic. They end up disliking psychology.
That's right.
No,
that's
not
right.
Even that. Yeah, not even that. Funny. I think what was interesting for me, that the takeaway I actually came up with was, you know, it's interesting because as an experiment, they saw it as an interesting outcome.
Right.
I don't believe they necessarily felt duped. And Jay addresses this.
They go through this big debriefing. He's very concerned that they not feel taken advantage of, or you know.
So in a true con, he really did do the close.
Well, philosophically, I don't know psychologically, but philosophically, it raises some pretty interesting questions, right? About assumptions and about certainty and about ideology and about power. And about just the walking in of the architecture and, whoa, I'm in a hospital. I'm in the neurological institute, don't you know? The assumptions that have already been made about the test that's going to happen in 20 minutes, that's not even a test.
And they have, there's actually magazines lying in the waiting room. Where they make you wait, of course. There's no reason to wait, but they make you wait.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And there's magazines with articles about mind-reading MRIs and the latest stuff.
And that's what I found interesting about the level of detail to the theatrics of what Jay specifically describes as the layering of the theatrics. He says it has to feel completely real. And you can see right down to the detail. I mean, this is where you applaud him as from the theatrical point of view. He's thought of it. They don't just walk in. They walk into this. They specifically go by the morgue. You want to say that this is a really dark and scary, and it's a big deal.
Yep.
You're dealing with real machinery, with real possibilities and outcomes.
Modern science, don't you know?
That's right. And so this is a real MRI, It's not an MRI that functions.
It's a non-functioning
MRI. Right, it broke. Right.
He got a call. They had a fake MRI before. Yeah. And he got a call at some point from the Neurological Institute. And they said, hey, you know anybody who has use for
a broken
MRI?
Yeah, I can't wait to see this done on stage. I wanna, yeah. Who's Fran Serrari? Is he going to start doing this soon or what? Yeah. So Plato didn't believe in the senses. I mean, he believed in the senses, but he didn't trust them. A lot of the early philosophers didn't, and still don't, probably.
Let's just say a lot of philosophers.
That's right. So should we be believing our eyes? I mean, it's a cliche, of course, but at what point do you say, who do I trust? What do I trust?
One of the great discoveries, and a real discovery that came, I mean, this magic has been very productive for science. So these guys using, you know, magic principles and ideas have discovered features of perception and cognition and so on that weren't known previously. They've actually uncovered new things or clarified things. And one of the things they clarified was this, you know, what happens when you see. So people say the hand is quicker than the eye and you know, as if it's the hand that deceives.
That's right, yeah.
And one of the things they found is, you know, in a simple vanish of a ball, they'd have the magician throw the ball apparently in the air and people would see the ball vanish. And a certain percentage, most people would just see the ball, oh, it's gone. Some people, quite a significant proportion, would report seeing the ball vanish in midair. Right? And they would describe it that way. And when questioned, would insist that they saw the ball in the air and it vanished. So what they did is they put these eye tracking devices on them and they can point to, you know, record exactly where the eye is. And what they discovered was that the eye isn't fooled at all, right? That the eye is actually looking where the ball is all the time.
Right.
But that's not what, you know, that seeing is more than looking.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that the consciousness itself and how the senses coordinate play and how the expectations work.
And that in itself is a really great insight into how we do perceive things. And that's what we as performers cannot get away with so much, but certainly take advantage of.
Absolutely.
And play toward, you know, and there's this idea of angles and objects and do they really disappear midair? And your senses are fooled because we understand the world a certain way. But if you tilt the world ever so slightly with a different angle, and all of a sudden you see a new perspective and voila, you know, a ball disappears in thin air. And it's great. It's a really great, we had fun doing that, actually.
Or the opposite happens. Yes, we have Julie's, also, we have, you know, throughout the film, Julie appears not only in the lab, like in Montreal, but on stage, on this beautiful stage, performing bits of magic. You know, so we see Julie vanish the ball there, but in Vancouver, Ronald Rensink at UBC, who is a renowned perception scientist, had no interest in magic. And this guy was studying machine vision. He was interested in, you know, making vision for robots and things like that, and couldn't figure out what how to solve certain problems. The field wasn't advancing very quickly, and so he thought, well, I'll study human perception, and I'll just port that over. We'll figure out, you know, I'll learn how human eyes work. I'll port that over to robots. Well, what he discovered is that we didn't know how human eyes work. He spent, you know, he got another PhD in that.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
And then he ended up studying problems of perception. One of the things that he was dedicated to was a joint project of MIT, Harvard, and Nissan to study accidents. And he was interested in a class of accident which has the unbelievable name of driver looks but does not see. And these are cases that we all know.
And we've all seen in the newspaper.
I've been a passenger in some of those cars.
It's happened to me. I've been the driver. I do not hesitate to admit where, you know, I completely missed something.
Right.
And luckily nothing came of it. I didn't smash into anyone, but I easily could have.
Yes. Sure.
Right. So
sure.
These are cases where the driver, where people say people are sober, they're not distracted, there's no obvious.
It's not dark, it's not rainy.
That's right. But they ram into a building and say, I didn't see the building. Yeah. I mean, things that seem absurd.
Absurd, yeah.
And so he started studying this, and he discovered his paper on this that he co-authored is considered the most cited paper in modern cognitive psychology. And this is really seminal work in the field. And he discovered what he called change blindness.
Mm.
You know, how a small splash of mud on the windscreen or a leaf fluttering at the side of the car could lock a person's attention in such a way that even though visually what was in front of their eye was receiving it, the information was going to their brain, but their attention was locked in such a way that that small change obliterated the big change. Well, he did his work, he came up with his conclusions, he published his stuff, and he thought to himself, this must have something to do with what magicians do. Right? Magicians make things disappear that are still there, and they make us not see them, and they make us see things that aren't there.
Like a freight train.
He thought, I should get in touch with some magicians.
Funny.
And that's how he got involved in magic and studying this other part of it. Right?
Well, there are implications for a lot of different disciplines. I mean, does this not maybe raise some questions about law? And about how law is practiced, and about reasonable doubt,
and about witnesses,
and witnesses, and all kinds of things.
Informants, yeah.
Well, just how about reliability, capital R, across the board?
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. No, it's these are questions that if you take seriously, and I say this to people, you know, if you watch this film, and you take seriously, you actually listen to what these people are saying, you watch what they're doing, you will not ever see the world the same again. I mean, these are things that undermine.
Of course, they do. Do they undermine them as a filmmaker, both as magicians, but as a performing magician? Do they undermine it for the sake of undermining, or is it is there a cause and effect here? I mean, entertainment. You want people to be sharing the wonder, right? You want to share that, and I totally get that.
Right.
I mean, that's I think a large part of why I still do it
because
of that moment that I remember.
Sure.
The first few times, and thankfully I still feel it from time to time. But it's not just about that, right? About undermining. It's about for the purpose of better questions, staying open, entertainment, and so on.
Well, I think asking for these questions.
Yeah,
questions.
Or just asking questions to begin with.
To be interesting, yeah.
But that subverting function, like subverting reality, subverting what we believe is real,
that's a really
wonderful,
great way to put it.
Important,
no, that's a really interesting way
you know, to put
it.
It's kind of the isn't it like sort of the basic, it's a kind of spiritual thing, right?
It's a
kind of insight into reality that you know,
comes great.
That's right. Yes, yes, yes. And was it really Spider-Man who said that for the first time?
Yeah, I believe it was.
It's troubling.
It was actually. Yeah. You made me think about one of the other experiments in Daniel's film, and it's about the power of influence, where people were convinced.
You talk about perceptual influence in the film,
where
right?
People were actually convinced. They said why, but really they said A.
Yeah. Right.
It was completely the opposite. One of the experiments proves that they were able to have people write down on a scorecard with strong opposing opinions, and the experimenter was able to reverse their opinion after they had just written down the opposite. They had the individual arguing against themselves, which I thought it's like a form of double talk.
Sure.
It's remarkable. Having seen a few of these guys do this double talk routine, about the law and influence.
Yeah, and was this just, I mean, the idea of delay comes out in the film for me too, and how important that is for a magician, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just that, and also for a politician and for a filmmaker and so many storytellers, right? We need this latency to how we do what we do. And I wonder to what degree, you know, this story you're telling about the change, the shift so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's probably layered. It's not any one thing that causes you to. Mm-hmm. But I know I've been convinced of something in one moment and pretty quickly, especially as a parent.
Sure.
It happens. And then you go, okay, that's just ego, right? Or
I think the real power in this is another kind of blindness. They call it choice blindness.
Mm, yes, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Where you're blind to your own choices.
Yeah.
You know, so and this is not casual choices. These are choices based on
strong opinions,
your basic values.
How do you feel about the budget? How do you feel about healthcare? Yeah. How do you feel
Trump
about
Trump or Clinton?
Yeah,
it was one of the first questions.
Yeah, they did. And I thought that was really interesting that here is someone who was totally 100% for Hillary Clinton, and the next thing you know, that same individual was singing the praise of why they would want Donald Trump in office. And it's it's remarkable to me that someone can be. How can that possibly be? Right. Wasn't that a great magic trick?
Well, right. No, for sure.
That was, for me, I think, the most.
It was fascinating.
Mind-boggling part.
Yeah.
Right. The thing about choice blindness, and as Thomas Strandberg, the experimenter in that case, said, you know, there's also choice blindness. He's, you know, it's like everyone hearing this thinks, oh yeah, so those people were stupid, right? They were just a little bit dense. Right. I, on the other hand, would not be fooled by this. And yes. He says, not only does everybody say that, but everybody's fooled by it.
So I interviewed Håvard Busnes, I hope I pronounced his name right, the Norwegian filmmaker, about a film that we talked about offline called Golden Dawn Girls. And this is relevant. And so we've got this right-wing, fascist, frankly Nazi movement coming out of Greece in response to everything that's going on in Greece, or has been for the last, I suppose, about 10 years. You want to talk about choice and blindness and inability to see the other. I mean, we can talk about the implications and the ethical implications, but how can I not convince them that the position they hold right now is probably not a good one?
Well, Strandberg's,
probably not great for humanity.
Strandberg's,
you know?
Position is that what they were very actually interested in when they did the Hillary Trump thing. This was at the first presidential debate. They were interested in seeing if they could get people with very polarized political opinions to have a more neutral, more open-minded position.
Right.
And they did it by, as Julie says, by switching their answers in front of them.
Right.
So they'd fill out a questionnaire.
And it wasn't covert. Like,
yeah, it's very
openly done.
There's a lesson for magicians.
It really was. The guy just really did it. There was no big push. There was no big aggression.
There was no pocket writing.
There was no secret move that he had to do. He just basically watched what they were writing, selected the opposite or the more neutral choices.
Sure, sure.
And then he just swapped them out. He really just put them on top of their answers.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating moment. And also the reactions are fascinating, right?
And
wonderful.
But what he says, as to why it's the power of this, is that it's not like arguing with someone else. You're being confronted with your own opinions. You've just filled out a questionnaire, and now the person is asking you, so in question one,
you said
that, you know, even though you're a Trump supporter, you said you thought Hillary, has more experience. She has, you know, she gets points for that. So, you know, why, a lot of your answers seem very open-minded.
Yeah.
Why did... Well, you know, I think it's important to be open-minded, even though...
I know, it's
and
ridiculous.
And that effect...
It was great.
When it's called out, it's ridiculous, but haven't we all done it, right?
That was a great point that he made, that it is still that everybody says, yeah, but I wouldn't get caught up.
That's
a great point.
That's right.
But also
the
reason it works is because you're not debating someone else. It's
right.
You
mm-hmm. right.
who've said these
things.
So you have to accommodate yourself to
sure.
that. And they found that indeed people would end up being more open-minded. Now that effect, sadly, doesn't last indefinitely.
Right.
But it did last for a while. And I have to believe, because they also debrief people. They show them what they've done.
They
reveal
the
experiment.
Yeah.
They talk to them about it. And I've got to believe that if an intelligent person falls for that, if I can put it that way, and sees what happened, they can no longer think about their opinions the same way, right? You've got to end up like being a little bit sort of open to the idea that there are other perspectives.
Yeah. When one of my favorite answers to people when they ask me something that they're hoping for a definitive response from me on is, well, everything comes with footnotes. That's my line in the last sort of 5 or 10 years. And I'd like to think that, you know, and this is what I love about any great documentary, is it's so layered. It's about magic. It's about science. It's about assumptions and asking questions and all those things. But you know what? If I can go a little idealistic, for me, it's about humility and hope. Seriously. I humbly
hope you're right.
But honestly, because isn't this what asking better questions is about? It's about, and about the reveal and all those things, and being okay with that and saying, okay, maybe we can't actually really know definitively, and tomorrow we're going to have new evidence that's going to suggest another outcome and a new response.
Yes, and I think that's the whole point, is that, and that's really how we chose to end it. It's kind of in a fun way because, do you really know? Did we really tell you?
Right.
Or did we tell you anything at all?
Yeah, the whole
Who's
thing.
Who's the magician?
That's
Who
right.
Who is the magician in this? And that really does resonate all the way through the film, is that, you know, it was great to bring the viewer through the labyrinth because really, ultimately, it is how we perceive the world. It is us being in the world that is part of the reason why it works. It's this human interaction that we have, that we desire to have, that, you know, we engage and we want to know. Some people want to have answers. Some people want wonder. You know, it works either way.
Well, and I think another thing for me, another layer for me, is that often there isn't just one answer.
Sure.
I mean, so many of these things are way more nuanced. I mean, 2 + 2 in most mathematical systems equals 4. But you know what? We're not talking about that now. We're talking about relationships. We're talking about the world. We're talking about politics and how difficult some of these things can be. It's very nuanced. It's all about delay. It's all about perception and uncertainty and deception and trust.
And like you said, there's a certain humility when you,
yeah.
or even, you know, maybe it's arrogance. I mean,
yeah,
when right. you realize that right. what your brain is doing, in fact, one of our scientists says that, you know, that the takeaway is that your brain is much smarter than you think.
Right.
right? It's so
Great
smart.
Mind.
It's able
yep.
to weave this world together
sure.
out of
fleeting notions, literally allowing our brains to thread together, and that's the line of assumptions that, you know, sometimes that is to be taken advantage of, and sometimes it saves us, you know, it causes us to stop and think about the whole perspective of what are we stepping into. It was a
So
really
Julie
fun.
Has this lovely line at the end. So Julie appears at the beginning of the film, magically, of course, and she disappears at the end of the film, and before she disappears, she's throwing this
hoop into
the hoop,
air, yeah.
The cloth that's covering her, and she says, you know, I don't remember your line, but it's like that. You know, you are the magician. It's your brain that's weaving this together. And I don't know, you know, I was immersed in this story for a long time, and I still get knocked out when I see that.
It's
astonishing.
Cool. Yeah, that's fun.
You know,
that's
the
fun.
The fact that you're blind 10% of the time,
yeah.
that your eyes
yeah.
are constantly only seeing fragments.
What I love about it from your perspective is as the filmmaker and as a human being and as a magician, I mean, you couldn't be more on the inside, right? And yet you're still kind of, wow, this
yeah,
is amazing.
That's
beautiful. I'm getting goosebumps.
That's,
like, honestly, I am. That's amazing. I think there's something really profoundly childlike about that I think we'd all do well to return to more often
yeah,
than not.
Great magic does that, doesn't it?
It does.
True.
It
and
really
great
does.
Science does
yeah.
that too.
Yeah.
Great science also inspires. You're
do,
right.
Do all MRI technicians wear as nice shoes as you do, though? Is the question.
We talked about this.
Yeah. And you're going to have to watch the film to find out what, pray tell, that means, that question. Thank you guys so much for joining
Thank
me today.
You. Thank you.
Talking
you.
About the science of magic airing. Tell us, it's on CBC. Kind of on demand for in perpetuity? Is it there
well,
for...
Well, they keep it up for a few years. I think.
Oh, good. Okay.
3 years, I think. It's
Excellent.
On the Nature of Things CBC website. Go to the Nature of Things episodes, and you'll find Science of Magic. Just search for it if you don't see it.
Wonderful talking with Julieng and Daniel Zuckerbrat today about the science of magic. Thanks,
and
guys.
David
for
Peck.
Yes. Your special guest host here on Face to Face.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.